And open a public hearing on House Bill 3529 relating to information technology. Welcome, Representative Mary Gallegos, sponsor of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Gallegos. I'm state representative for House District 29, which is Forest Grove, Cornelius, and Hillsboro. And I'm interested in information technology. It's an important thing for my district. Being from Western Washington County, I spent 20 years in the high-tech industry, and what a culture shock it was to come here to the state of Oregon and see how things operate. And, of course, as I have a responsibility to my taxpayers during this difficult budget cycle, I feel it's commensurate upon us to look under every rock, every stone, and, of course, are we doing the best that we can to be as efficient and saving money where we can to... make sure that we are using all the resources wisely, especially in my district, which a school district that is noteworthy that has, closed 17 days early. As I have personal interest there because my husband works for that school district and, of course, lost 17 days plus of pay throughout that this whole year. We're continuing to feel that. So I had proposed House Bill 3529. It's a bill which was difficult to draft because if it doesn't exist in statute, it doesn't exist. And all of the information technology resources in the whole state can't be quantified. We can't find out how much we're spending. We don't. There's no asset tracking system. A bill passed in the 01 session hasn't been implemented yet. There were no dollars left, apparently, for the organization to implement that properly. So we had difficulty trying to create a framework on how to consolidate using models that I had seen in the private sector and other state governments use. But, of course, I was willing and flexible to look at other alternatives, met several times with the governor's office and provided a variety of options and proposals, and as well drafted several amendments. I have the Dash 1 amendment creates a public corporation modeled after OHSU. To deliver IT services to the state, met with Peter Kohler through an IT a House IT task force, met and talked with him about some of the successes and difficulties that they had transitioning from an agency and some of the issues that we might face trying to transition delivery mechanisms back to the state agencies by consolidating, going through that model. Have also a Dash 2 amendment, and I could have the Dash 2 and Dash 1 mixed up, but taking a different look at how to organize, either placing all the assets, people, technology into one organization that exists, the other one creates a whole new agency, and I'm flexible on the prospect of, what we need to do to reorganize, but I think it is important to look at a long-term plan that's effective, that's useful, that's possible, so that we can go look at savings that can be used to help fund some of the necessary programs we've got. Now, I have dug trying to find what we're spending on IT to understand the order of magnitude, and there's no data available. It's difficult to go try to find out how much we're spending on computers, how much we're spending on people, how much projects are costing. They, as you well know, in your budget process, they come through piecemeal. There's no one single source to go find them. So I have gleaned through a variety. It's an interesting little formula I put together, and checked with other sources, it's about $1.8 billion that we're spending on IT in the state, and this would include telecommunications.
Is that per biennium, Representative Gallegos?
In a biennium.
Okay, thank you.
So when you're looking at $1.8 billion, and that would include telecommunications, network infrastructure, data centers, all the things that I see as being IT, and in a very broad sense. That's the desktop support, your desktop systems, and it's a significant amount of money. Now, even a very minor savings on that is $100 million if you look at 10%. $100 million would go a long way to help projects, like the Oregon Project Independence, which is severely underfunded this session. We've got a lot of high-tech and knowledge economy initiatives that we have not been able to fund and are on the back burner with the OCED pieces that need small amounts of money to really to make a significant difference for higher education and some of the economic development we're sorely lacking in. And for their $20 million they're asking in the Engineering Technology Industry Council, that $100 million would go a long way to fund some of these. And that's at the small end of just a small percentage savings. If we look at and what I'm seeing is happening in the industry as well as the private sector, what they've been saving and what other states that I've seen who've had successes, there are states who've had failures, but it all was about the direction from the top, the executive branch, the legislature, and their commitment to want to make a change and to move into this new information technology era.
Can you share with us the states that have had successes and failures relative to consolidation of their information technology?
Michigan, Virginia, Arizona, Washington has had some initiatives that they have taken off that have been quite successful. California has taken a step forward, a step back, and now they're working on a new plan to move forward again. Utah has made some significant steps. New Mexico is doing some as well. And I would just mention that a lot of those states that are making these advances are states who have made significant investments in the economic development realm with the high-tech industry that they've brought into the state. I think it's imperative upon us to understand that the knowledge-based economy and the technology-based economy that we hope to enjoy in this state is our new natural resource. Washington County has enjoyed it for many, many years, and we'd like to propagate that throughout the rest of the state. And I think if we do want to cultivate it as our new natural resource, that it needs the attention it deserves. And that's a piece in the bill as well, to asking for cabinet-level chief technology officer, chief information officer, someone in the executive branch that has the authority and ability to deliver this and drive the direction throughout the state. But also, this is an internal movement as well as an external movement to get the focus on this new natural resource that we can cultivate back into our state within state government and within the state. So I have lots of documents that I have just hesitated to copy to you only because I didn't want to spend the money if I didn't have to out of my budget to copy them, but I'm more than happy to give you copies of any and everything I have.
Questions for Representative Davis, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple. One is, Representative Gallegos, if I understand the direction that you're headed, you're trying to stop duplication, stop amateur attempts within agencies to develop IT, consolidate all the IT certified smart guys in one place. Talk a little bit about how this might have prevented the kind of disaster that occurred several years ago at DMV, where they completely change their driver's license records processes.
Well, clearly that's an interesting model. The trying to get everybody back in the one organization, I think that creates accountability. Accountability, you are able to help the employees. We don't invest in our employees in state government. Private sector invests in their employees with training, technology training, and keeping their skills marketable. I think that that's something that we need to do as a state government as we consolidate and put these people into one agency. They're able to share expertise and understand all the systems throughout state government. Will they all work across one another? I think that there's more oversight should that happen, and I think it would have happened sooner. I don't know whether we could have prevented it at the time, not knowing who was in charge and what the skills and expertise were. I think had we had an executive level chief technology officer directing how we would use technology, there would have been a plan, and an organization would have driven to that plan.
Follow up, Chair.
Okay.
I guess this is the more pertinent question that I have, having observed government both as being an agency head for a while and now in the legislature. The bureaucracy abhors a vacuum, and when you begin creating a whole new branch or a whole new agency to deliver this, what assurances have you built into your bill or into the kind of thinking that you have done around this bill that prevents the creation of another entrenched bureaucracy that continues to grow? And where are the connect points with the other agencies? I'm not sure that you can take a private sector model and transplant it directly into how government works, and I'm looking for what language in your bill tries to prevent the creation of another immovable bureaucracy where information is concentrated there and it's not dispersed out to the agencies meaningfully.
Sure. like I, hopefully I indicated, I think this is a work in process. That's the type of input I want to get and hear from people. I'm not locked into any particular draft of the bill or amendment. I think it's a direction we have to go and have to try to push the state towards it. My understanding is there have been many, many initiatives in the state to actually do that, but nothing has ever been successful, and we see the cost of IT growing up. I think as an agency, yes, I realize that there's a culture difference between private sector and in the state. And are there assurances to prevent people from digging in their heels? You know, I don't know what can be put in, and I'm certainly amenable to do that. Would hope for the help of those who are currently in that realm within state government to offer solutions. I've talked to some. They've had some ideas about what the specific language would be in accounting, you know, accountability or reporting mechanisms of different representatives throughout. I mean, one of the models has the employees stay where they're at and stay kind of in a matrix position in the organization they're at because they're basically policy experts. They can bring the policy experts, and in one method it brings them all into one organization, and in their sphere do we in a reporting structure. So I'm flexible and don't really know the answer, but I'm open and wanting to look for it to make sure it's the right thing. Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Gallegos? Thank you, Representative Gallegos. You're welcome to join us here at the dais so that the other questions can be asked. We'll try and stay as much on schedule as we possibly can. Cindy Becker, Deputy Director, Department of Administrative Services. Cindy, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, Cindy Becker, Assistant Director of the Department of Administrative Services. I've been asked to speak about a number of issues, including this bill, the Burns Archive Center, the EDS assessment of the General Government Data Center, and the Secretary of State audit. And I don't know that I can do all that in 10 minutes, but I will get as far as I can and would be happy to stay after or to be invited back hopefully another time if I don't get to all the questions. I'd like to start with the discussion about House Bill 3529. For the record, the department is opposed to the bill as it currently sits. You're going to hear a lot from the other invited guests here talking about consolidation and outsourcing. And I think it's important for me to let you know is that we are not opposed to either of those methodologies. What our concern is the extreme, what we perceive as the extreme nature of this bill, which consolidates all government IT into a single location. Currently, in the bill as it currently stands, it's within the Department of Administrative Services. I know Representative Gallegos has talked about some other options of public corporation. But regardless of the entity, we are very concerned about such consolidation. And what I wanted to do is talk to you about some of the things that have happened in other states and other jurisdictions and some information that we've got from other certified smart people, I think, as Representative Johnson would talk about it. We think that the issue of centralization is actually becoming less of the end goal as opposed to balancing, and that's really where the department is coming from. We do feel that it makes sense to centralize certain parts of IT, the infrastructure parts, the data centers, the networks. However, where we differ with Representative Gallegos' bill is we also feel fervently that the application development needs to remain at the business unit level. And I want to read some things for you. I'm not used to reading. I'm used to just talking, so forgive me. I do want to read some things. This is from Government Technology Magazine in February of 2003. And the issue is getting the balance right. And the and let me just read a few things. The rationale for rigid centralized control of IT projects and purchasing held that IT is important enough to merit a cabinet-level presence in states, and such a presence cultivates an environment in which CIOs can implement enterprise-wide technology changes. The wisdom of that approach is increasingly questioned. What we're looking at is creating the need for a more collaborative approach to IT management. The director of the University at Albany Center for Technology and Government says this debate over centralized versus decentralized, for strong versus weak, is really coming to the fore. Neither extreme model works very well. Complete decentralization gives you no economies of scale, no way to build a common robust infrastructure. However, complete centralization forces all decisions that should be made at various levels of authority or at various points in the system based focus on where the knowledge lies to a single point, and that doesn't work well either. Everyone is struggling to find the right middle ground. Additional comments from the chief strategist of Intel talks about moving to an interoperability architecture is perhaps the biggest challenge governments face in the future. And this is from Chris Thomas, as I said, is the chief strategist of Intel Corporations. Governments need to move from an enterprise architecture to an interoperability architecture where disparate systems work together but can't control each other's destinies. What he also says is giving somebody the job of a centralized architecture for government is actually setting them up for failure. Providing them with the job of advocating interoperability and driving the standardization of interoperability between the organizations is setting them up for success. Another individual who talks about it, he talks about it in terms of a federation. That is Steve Kolodny, who was the CIO of the state of Washington. He's received numerous awards for all the terrific work he's done there. And he's talking about we're moving from a centralized view of technology to a federated view of technology in which everybody gets to play. We're in a period in which agency power rises, central power falls, and you get into confederated arrangements where governance makes all the difference. Some other examples, the new CIO of Philadelphia was brought into the city to centralize IT services and management, but soon abandoned that approach. When we came in and really looked at the environment here, how ready the organization was, and what it was going to take to move us there, it was evident that we had to take a little slower and find something that worked better for Philadelphia. And this is one of the important issues here. To us, it's not just about the technology. It's about the culture. And I think Dallas passed out a report that we put together in April. And what we're really talking about is Oregon is an extremely decentralized state when it comes to government services. We're not a Nike where there's a single brand. We can't even get a single brand in some agencies, much less all of state government. It's a lot more difficult to move a culture of 130 different agencies with various constituencies to a centralized environment and assume that that's going to succeed. The issue for us is really interoperability. It's not having one system or one place. What it's all about is standards. And creating standards where everybody can play. And therefore, you control that through the standards as opposed to a single mechanism. I can tell you when I was at the Department of Human Services, we did centralize IT. Senator Winters knows that we centralized a variety of administrative services. I can tell you that it was painful at best. It took 5 years in a single agency to try to centralize that, and they're still feeling some of the pain from it. I'd also like to talk a little bit about what happened in California, not so much the specifics. California did centralize in a Department of Information Technology. It failed. And Representative Gallegos mentioned that, and they're trying to figure out what to do next. As a result of the failure, the California State Auditor did a lot of research and issued a report about the whole issue of IT governance. And what the audit report said is that states who have had success at IT consolidation first determine the appropriate amount of consolidation and centralization. The best approach is a modular, incremental development and implementation of IT initiatives. Agencies have unique requirements, different relationships with their customers. A one-size-fits-all policy can limit flexibility and may be inappropriate or costly. I'd like to mention a few things that happen in some other states and jurisdictions. And again, it's not to cast aspersions about the concept of outsourcing and consolidation. We truly believe it has its place. I'm going to tell you about some of the things we're doing in Oregon to get there. But I think it's important to recognize that there isn't I don't know if I use the word magic or silver bullet, but one of those things. There isn't one of those to make things wonderful. In 1999, San Diego County let a contract and outsourced all of the services. In 2002, the title of this article is California Nightmare. The county declares that the vendor is in default. NASA announced in April 2003 that they are going to work their mammoth contract, which the agency awarded to a vendor in 1998 for $3.4 billion. After 5 years, NASA realized that the communication needs for its different programs and centers required different solutions. In other words, one size does not fit all. In Connecticut, they outsourced all their state IT operations, proposed in 1996 for a 98-99 budget. They projected significant savings. After 4 years in 1999, the governor and the state CIO dropped the outsourcing initiative. In Michigan, they have really worked hard for 10 years to to incrementally get to consolidation. They started in 92 with the CIO office established. They've worked hard on data consolidation, network consolidation, desktop standardization, and they now have a full consolidation. But again, this was after 10 years of doing it step by step, and we're really hoping that it continues to be successful.
Cindy, do you feel like that the Department of Administrative Services is headed that direction now, step by step?
I think that we are making some steps around a consolidation of infrastructure, which is where we think we need to be.
Okay.
I'd also like to comment in Georgia. In June 2003, a $1.87 billion telecommunications outsourcing deal was canceled. Again, there's lots of good things about it, but if you try to get too much too fast, and the risk is enormously high, it sometimes just doesn't work. The other issue that I think is important to mention is consolidation is not without cost. I know in the state of Virginia, which I do want to mention, and to be honest with you, everyone's watching Virginia. Virginia just passed legislation this year to consolidate IT. It's a sweeping change in Virginia. They're also doing a sweeping change, actually, in reforming all of government. So it really is in lockstep with the way they're going to change and view government. Again, when you have a decentralized system that Oregon has, it's going to be very difficult to have a consolidated model or centralized model of IT with a decentralized business services. I know in Virginia they spent millions of dollars just in studies and doing data consolidation studies. These types of things cost money to even figure out where you want to go. We're going to spend some of that money, but I know in some cases the consolidations in and of themselves are not without costs. In some cases, I know that when it comes to outsourcing, I think you're probably going to hear that some vendors have, in fact, bought the capital, paid the state for all of its resources, and then they have a long-term contract. Again, sometimes that can work, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it takes the stars aligning, I think, but it takes a lot of solid work and planning. Let me talk a little bit about what Oregon is pursuing in the area of consolidation. As I mentioned, we have been a very agency-centric state, and you'll see that in the report that I handed out to you. And agencies were rewarded for that. You were rewarded for getting all you could. You were rewarded for getting your stuff. You weren't necessarily rewarded for being part of the enterprise. And clearly in the 90s, when Oregon economy was doing well, there was not even a thought of trying to make sure that what you did fit into the enterprise, whether it was IT, whether it was HR, whether it was any of the administrative services. We have been meeting for the past year to try to change that whole model, to try to change the thinking, particularly, and to be honest, the catalyst is the economy. We can't afford silos. We can't afford 130 silos. The question is, how far should we go in that consolidation? And that's the balance we're trying to achieve. We have a CIO council with about, 40? 40 CIO, well, they call, they're 40, the CIO Council, we have one CIO, but we have other agencies that call some of their managers CIOs, so it's, sometimes you'll hear the state has 50 or so CIOs. We don't, but they're titles. Anyway, the IT managers in these agencies are getting together for the first time. They're putting standards together for the first time. I mean, to be honest with you, some of them have never met before this last year because there was no need to.
Question, Representative Johnson.
Thanks. Ms. Becker, it's a disconnect for me that they have titles, but they don't do the work. I mean, it seems counterintuitive what you just said. Why would you bear the title and not discharge that function?
Representative Johnson, because when you're looking at silos, these individuals are CIOs for their agency. And so they've had that title of CIO. They do the work. But when you think of a state CIO, you would typically not think of an agency specific. But for years, as everything's grown up around agencies, these IT managers, and particularly the large agencies, Department of Transportation and DHS, their IT chiefs are CIOs. Because that's the model that the state has always had, a decentralized model.
So there could be a CIO of ODOT, and there could be a CIO of DAS.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
ODOT, DAS, CIO, yeah. Just because the pig's
and
gone.
The pig is gone, so...
Department of Community and Business Services, wait, I have money. I'll just put it on the table. But I think it reflects the culture, Representative Johnson. And it's not to say that they're not doing that work. It's just if you're into titles and looking at titles, in the private sector, for example, you'd probably have a single CIO, even if you had other large domains.
Follow-up.
What's disturbing me is when you say into titles. in state government, those titles all come with job classifications and pay. I understand into titles in the private sector, but I think DAS has a responsibility to worry about into titles. When you're describing state employees, the functions they're supposed to have, when we're worried about accountability, I guess I just reject the notion into titles is an adequate explanation when your agency is charged with making sure that jobs match the duties, that duties are appropriate, and that that all fits into a pay scale that's appropriate for the classification.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there is a distinction between a job classification and a working title. We control the job classifications, and everybody in those classifications do meet the specifications of that. So you'll have individuals in program PEM, program exec manager series. The working titles for those jobs are selected by the agencies.
Follow-up.
My experience in state agencies suggests to me that pretty soon classifications creep to meet the titles. I just make that as an observation.
Let me talk again where we're going in terms of the CIO Council. The CIO Council has been putting together standards. They're working on enterprise-wide security standards, architecture standards, and looking at the other issue of data center consolidation. The data center assessment is in process. We have a group that's looking at that. You'll notice in the report there are three main data centers at the Department of Administrative Services, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Transportation. There are also a variety of mini data centers. There's approximately 1,500 servers out there. There's all different variations. And again, agencies have purchased those on their own when that was really the way that government operated. We're now looking at doing an assessment to look at what variation or what format of consolidation and or outsourcing makes sense for the data centers. We fully agree that we cannot leave the status quo.
Yes, Senator, I apologize because I need to go in and have my meeting with the co-chairs, but something you said just struck a chord, and I was reminded of that I was back before I left this building in 1981 when we talked about making certain that we weren't duplicating efforts in this whole new arena of high tech and information networking, and some of the activity that you're describing today that the CIO group is doing is some of the same activity that was described 20 years ago. What's happened? But what has not happened?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think the second part of your question, which is what has not happened, is the reality. There was not the executive leadership or desire to put that as a priority. The area was the discussions were around programs, and when it came to administrative functions, business functions such as finance and human resources and information technology, the agencies were left to their own resources to be able to access the appropriate resources to make the systems work for them. And there was not a discussion at Ways and Means, you know, back 20 years ago about, well, what does this mean for the enterprise? It was, do you have the IT resources for your agency? Do you have the human resources for your agency? The discussions about the larger system was not something that was seemed to be a priority, and so agencies continued to get their stuff.
Follow up, Representative Johnson, or Representative Senator Winters.
Yes, because at that time it was Exec Department and not DAS was putting together the pieces in order to present to the legislative body. And when I ask what happened, I'm very serious of what happened, because this discussion is 22 years old. And simply to say, well, that this body was not interested, I don't think is a fair statement either, because it takes both bodies in order to come together to make certain that we're doing what is best for the state of Oregon. And so it is troublesome to me that 22 years we're still talking about the same subject.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I didn't mean to imply it was this body. It was, I mean, clearly there was not the leadership in the executive branch that put this as a priority. And so you didn't see those types of plans.
Thank you very much. We're going to have a couple more questions for you, Cindy, and then we're going to go on with the agenda.
Okay.
We know that we can get you back another day to speak on some of the concerns and issues. Wanted to make sure that the Senate had an opportunity to quiz you. Representative Gallegos, question?
Yeah, you recently were talking about, direction from the top, and you've recently hired a new CIO. But that CIO, can you explain what his power and authority is over other state agencies as far as being able to set direction? My understanding is he reports down under a couple DAS levels, and my concern is buried down there. Again, we'll continue with the 22-year-old story, getting older, and still not be able to affect change and direction.
Current status of our CIO. Who is our CIO?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gallegos, we have recently hired Dr. Don Fleming, and he reports to the director of the Department of Administrative Services. He will report. He starts August 1st. His background is primarily in the private sector. He worked for Jack Welch at GE, for Allied Signal, for numerous private sector organizations, most recently at Brookhaven National Lab. He has an undergraduate degree in physics from Yale and a PhD in nuclear physics from the University of Massachusetts, so we decided it does take a rocket scientist to actually do IT. But we're very excited about him coming, and he's very passionate about this. So he's not buried within the will not be buried within the organization of DAS. And he will be charged with carrying out the statutes, and he will provide the leadership role not only for DAS in terms of IRMD, but also leading the entire charge for state government to look at the areas of consolidation, whether it be in data centers or networking. And so also reporting directly to Gary Weeks, you get the clout both ways, since because of Gary's role as a director of state operations.
Additional follow-up, Representative Gallegos.
Yeah. Well, does he have the statutorial authority as the CIO to actually put out an edict, put out a plan, or does he have to then work through the agency head to do that? You're saying he needs to implement. He will be implementing these things statewide. Does he have that authority? My understanding is currently the CIOs don't have. The previous ones haven't had the authority, and that was what we were told as I'm researching this, why didn't some things happen? They don't have the authority to make any of these things happen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gallegos, the authority rests with the Department of Administrative Services, and a variety of the statutes around RMD talks about the department developing standards and developing other issues with state agencies, and agencies shall comply with. There is nothing in statute says that speaks specifically to the CIO. It talks about the Department of Administrative Services, IRMD. But the authority is vested certainly in the statutes and with the authority of the Director of State Operations and the Governor's Office in concert with the CIO.
Help me with the Director of State Operations.
Gary Weeks.
Gary Weeks. Okay, that's Department of Administrative Services. Okay. Cindy, we'll go ahead and thank you very much for your testimony. We are running a little bit behind at this particular point. Representative Gallegos, the next people on your invited list, you want to go ahead and invite them to come forward?
Yeah, let me look at my list. Oh, thank you. Dylan, did you have somebody here from IQ? Oh, I didn't even get the. Oh, but excellent. I have some guests here from Lockheed Martin.
Please.
They'll want to
invite them forward, if you would, please.
Come to the dais here.
Enter and sign in. You have handouts. We'll gather those from you.
We were told we should have 20, so we've got 20. Well, enough for the folks here and then folks in the audience. But I've invited Carolyn Barber from Lockheed Martin. She's brought with her today.
Cy Williams.
And they'll be talking about some of the work that they do out with other states, private sector companies.
Excellent.
Are we ready?
Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come here to speak today. We've been asked to speak specifically about IT consolidation, and we'll briefly touch on outsourcing, but primarily focused on IT consolidation. And we're gonna give you some information relative to our background and our experience relative to we're gonna spend time talking about our background, our experience, and what the state should anticipate relative to benefits associated with IT consolidation. But when we talk about IT consolidation, what I think the state is really interested in is optimizing its IT spending. So there's typically three things that that the state should be concerned about. Before I get into that, I need to introduce myself, I guess. I'm Cy Williams. I'm a program manager, general manager for Lockheed Martin Information Technology. We have a data center in Hillsboro, Oregon. We employ about 350 Oregonians in that data center, supporting customers like Nike, Goodyear, Simon & Schuster, Cummins Engine, and TSI. And based on the discussions that we've had previously with the state, we do believe that there is some significant opportunities for savings relative to consolidation. So there's three parts of the optimization and the savings that we think the state should consider. The first part is obviously the consolidation effort. The second part is standardization. And the third is being able to leverage once you've done that consolidation and standardization. Okay. Let's go to page three and talk a little specifically about the Lockheed Martin experience and what we've achieved relative to some of the consolidation efforts that we've undertaken. Lockheed Martin itself is a corporation that has had to do a substantial amount of consolidation with the integration of various different businesses. If you look at what we indicate on page three, it's really a combination of 18 various different sundry companies, each of which had their own data centers, their own networks, their own infrastructure. And so a significant amount of cost associated with that. The whole point of this chart is to indicate to give you an indication of what Lockheed Martin was able to achieve rather to consolidating its operations and standardizing. And as a result of our consolidation efforts, we've been able to achieve $2 billion of savings since 1994. Some of that savings actually went to the bottom line, but a significant amount of that savings actually was reinvested in the business. So we think the state certainly has some potential opportunities to take some savings associated with consolidation and reinvest that to fund maybe some other programs. Okay. But our consolidation effort consists of consolidating complex networks. Each of these entities that came together had their own networks, their own data centers, their own help desks, as well as their own applications. Let's go to the next page. When you talk about what's happening in some of the other states, certainly there are other states that are considering consolidating their efforts, and there are various degrees of success associated with consolidation. But it really kind of depends on what the overall goal is from a consolidation standpoint. Certainly, if the consolidation is primarily focused on infrastructure consolidation, that's typically the least difficult of the tasks relative to consolidation. But if the agency or if the state is interested in cross-agency integration of strategy and policy, that becomes, as well as consolidating all of its infrastructure, that becomes a little more difficult.
Okay. Mr. Williams, Representative Senator Winters, please.
Can you elaborate a little more on the cross-agency issue? And you said that that's a little more difficult.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Senator Winters, what happens from a cross-agency consolidation standpoint is when organizations attempt to consolidate applications, same applications across the board, there is, as opposed to accepting that there are some uniquenesses that need to occur within individual agencies. So what we've done to address that is looking specifically at those things that we consider shared services, that those are the things that make sense to be common across the entire organization, as opposed to forcing everyone to have all the same apps to run their business.
So you're looking at the commonalities among these?
Yes, absolutely. We look at the commonalities. We define what those things are that should be considered that are shared services kind of across the business. And those are the things that that you want to consolidate into and accept that the businesses themselves have some unique requirements and for specific applications that that will still need to probably be different.
Okay. That's what I think Representative here Cindy Becker indicated that there were at the application level different needs, and so you would find those needs at the application level, but that there could be some infrastructure consolidations.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Okay. Certainly from an infrastructure standpoint, that's the easiest part of the consolidation effort, but the application has become a little more difficult.
Okay, and so in the consolidation efforts, you've got infrastructure. Are there other levels of consolidation or other levels of in the consolidation efforts in that process?
Well, when we talk about the infrastructure, what we're talking about is the data center operations,
right.
The data centers, the facilities themselves, the networks, and primarily the desktop support, all the operations things. Those things that can be common.
But the uniqueness of the application levels is then that's at the standardization, the second step of implementation.
Yeah, from a standardization standpoint, what we would look to is those things that are common requirements across the entire business. Things such as maybe HR, things such as accounts payable, accounts receivable, those types of applications.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you. You may be leading in a direction that could phase some of this consolidation in isolated pieces. I guess that's what I'm asking, knowing very little about really what you're talking about in terms of the massive consolidation. Maybe some of the concern is the scope of the consolidation. And I think as you've been touching on functions like HR or some of the accounting functions, what I'm trying to get a sense of is how practical or realistic is it to talk about a phased consolidation, so you take those common functions and you do them incrementally. And I'm thinking of trying to break down some of the resistance agency to agency to any consolidation, and I don't know the practical barriers to phasing consolidation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think it's very practical to phase the consolidation. Certainly the first part of that phasing could be the infrastructure piece. Typically infrastructure consolidation activities that we've been engaged in, whether it's consolidation work that we've done internally for Lockheed Martin or the 40 or so consolidation activities that we've done for some of our commercial clients, are things that require maybe 6 to 9 months worth of planning, and you end up implementing doing these things maybe over a 72-hour weekend. So the infrastructure becomes the things that are somewhat easier to get your arms around, and there's a whole lot more process and training issues associated with when you want to change applications and that type of stuff. So it would certainly be something that you would have to phase if you're going to be successful.
Mr. Williams, could you give us a little bit of a timeline that, on that process, getting
yes.
your arms around the infrastructure and then that phase in?
Mr. Chairman, I would certainly like to do that, but I do have some timelines and some literature.
Oh, okay. All right.
Great.
I'd be
glad
to go through those charts. Is that responsive, Representative?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to chart number 5. In terms of just what you should or could expect from consolidation efforts, We collect some data from AMR research, and that research indicates that anywhere from 20% to 30% reduction in data center operating costs can be achieved through consolidation. Some basic rules of thumb in terms of estimates relative to eliminating servers. I think one of the previous presenters indicated that the state has approximately 1,500 servers or so. So we provided some data there. We do suggest that we look to get some help from organizations that have accomplished or that has a competency relative to data center consolidations if you really want to move these things forward and get the savings going much earlier. Okay. So go to the next page. This page 6 actually talks to the the cost savings and the time frame associated with some of the consolidation efforts. And this is specifically dealing with when you're doing some of the infrastructure consolidations, the planning that needs to occur to prepare for the consolidation, and typically the project management expertise and the risk management associated with accomplishing those tasks. And as indicated before, application consolidation is really something that's ongoing over time, but the infrastructure consolidation is typically those things where there's clearly kind of some start and finishes to that, and you accomplish that way. Okay. But it really kind of depends on how aggressive the state wants to be relative to its consolidation efforts and planning associated with that. Page 7, we talk specifically to some of the benefits, beyond cost savings, certainly the simplification platforms, standardizing processes and procedures, and just simply rationalizing all the applications that exist and being getting a better handle from the assets in the portfolio. I think one of the previous speaker mentioned what the state of New York is doing. If you go to their website, they'll talk specifically about their goals with their consistent service delivery, access to technology, better management of their personnel, and leveraging technology investments. Page 8 specifically talks to some of the elements that should be considered when you're doing consolidation, certainly the telecom, consolidating volumes, getting some economies of scale with those providers, your mainframe systems, being able to consolidate and make adjustments to capacity and lease agreements and leverage best practices, distributed computing, all those servers that you have out there in all the different locations, being able to better leverage those things. Applications, we mentioned earlier, those are the types of things that are really more ongoing and take probably the preponderance of the time to complete. And then, of course, the procurement and people. Okay. Some examples of Lockheed Martin engagements with state agencies and commercial customers are on the next page. And I think the last chart is the consolidation effort is a complex activity, and it really requires individuals that have experience to pull this particular activity off. And so I certainly want to suggest to the state that it utilizes the people who have the experience to accomplish these types of tasks. I think there are some. What we've done is we provided you some additional information in the handouts, some case studies, as well as a detailed AMR report that talks specifically to consolidation.
Are there further questions for Mr. Williams? Senator Winters?
Mr. Chair, just a question. I noted that on your mainframe, you talked about the capacity or lease agreement rather than is that one of the primary places to start? Because I raise this because I can remember, and I go back to 20-some years, when the question was around mainframing, and we hear constantly that there isn't the capacity currently. I mean, so mainframing seems to be at the heart of the guts of some of this. Is that an accurate assumption?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I think that there is potential savings in all of the areas. It really kind of depends on where the state is in terms of its resources and how it's utilizing the mainframe. I don't have enough information to make a judgment on the state's case relative to the mainframe being
adequate or not.
Yeah.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Does Cindy know whether the current mainframe is adequate or inadequate?
There are very few mainframes, and each of them are a different capacity. So, the problem is a bill center.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Representative Gables.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've also invited some representatives from EDS, and one gentleman will come and present for us. They also, clearly a worldwide company who specializes in these type of services. I'll introduce Alden Shocker, because I know her name, but if she would introduce or have met identify himself as the presenter.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for inviting us to speak. My name is Dick Callahan, and I'm from Sacramento, California, and I'm responsible for our U.S. West government business, and that includes states, cities, counties in west of Colorado. A little bit about EDS. We're a Fortune 100 company. We have 9,000 clients worldwide, many of whom are in the process of doing data consolidation, such as what you've talked about today. And in fact, that process never ends. It's a consistent, ongoing process for our customers. We have about 140,000 employees worldwide, $21 billion in revenue. Specifically in the West, our customers are Adidas, Chevron, Del Monte, the states of Oregon, California, Idaho, and most recently the city of Anaheim, which is a good example in itself. Large customers in the U.S., our most famous customer is General Motors, which bought us in the mid-80s, which you've probably heard that story before, sold us in the mid-90s. Well, we also have Xerox, Weyerhaeuser, and in our customer list. We can go to benefits of IT consolidation. I think it's our customers will verify that they can reduce cost, and they do that through leveraging of people, the hardware that they use, the software, and then space related resources such as cooling systems, backup systems, raised floors, all of that sort of thing. So they can, by having consolidation, they can reduce those costs. And it allows the state or our customers to reallocate those resources to either improve services or to reduce staff, either one. It also improves sharing and access of information because you've got success stories that you can share. It's more easily communicate amongst the technical staff and the subject matter experts. So that's an advantage of a consolidation. And finally, there's more secure systems, especially in today's with the HIPAA requirements and the security and the hacking going on. The firewalls, that's definitely a concern of all of our customers. If we can move to the EDS customer success, we picked out one in particular because it is a state in Australia that did outsource and consolidate, and they've been extremely successful. It's a South Australian government, and they are generally recognized as the first whole government IT consolidation and outsourcing contract. It was in 1995, and they've been successful in consolidating 1,000 sites across 80 agencies. And they estimate that they are saving $55 million over the nine-year contract, and I think you will find, they will say, that they have, in addition to those savings, they've had improved services. We took on their staff, so their staff became EDS employees, and I've talked to some of those employees, and they found that they've had greater opportunity to advance in their chosen career with EDS. So that's an advantage that, you know, a lot of us worry about is what happens to the people. And so they're more satisfied in there with their career decisions. And finally, it allows the state to give better service, which we said for that, so that the ultimate users, the citizens of the state, are more satisfied with the access to information and services within the state. If we can go to the last page now, there definitely are challenges that you need to think about. When you embark upon a consolidation effort like this, it must have buy-in from the top down. And if you don't have that, and it's like any project, if you don't have that buy-in, if you don't have that champion at the top of the organization, then it's a tough road. You have to plan for change management. Change is hard, no matter what it is, and you have to think about it. You have to have a plan in place to make those changes. And it's not just people; it's the processes in place and what can happen and all of those kinds of things. During the transition, there will be problems. There will be things that people didn't think about, and it's nobody's fault. It just there will be issues, and you have to fight through those. But in the long run, our customers have found it to be worthwhile. One of the key things that will make or break a process like this is defining scope. I think an assessment up front about what can be done and a clear roadmap of where you're going is critical to the success of the project. Scope creep will kill any project, no matter what it is. And there is upfront resources required. And the assessment is an example of one of those where you have to figure out what you're going to do before you do it.
Other questions of Mr. Callahan? Thank you very much, Mr. Callahan. The South Australian government began in 1995 that IT transition and consolidation. Is that correct? And do you know how much they were expending at that time when you began that consolidation?
No, I don't, but I can find out that information.
Okay. And they have 80 agencies, about 1,000 sites. Do you know anything about, and I'm sorry I don't know more about the state of South Australia, do we know anything about the size of that state in relationship to, and the cities,
yeah,
population, those kinds of things?
The major city is Adelaide, but I don't know the size.
Okay. And their savings are estimated to be $55 million over a $9 million contract. I assume that's the brute amount of savings, not the amount that's reinvested back in.
Yes.
We've heard about the opportunity for that would come from leveraging the size and scale of the economies, but then I'm assuming that they're enhancing their services because there is evidently some enhanced services. And finally, the fact there's better, more reliable service, I assume that there's some public feedback that we get that shows that there's some success and enjoyment, pleasure with the system.
The interesting part about this contract, in fact, is when I get back to Sacramento, there is a person from EDS coming to visit with me to promote companies and products that are coming from this state. So it was not just consolidation, but it was economic development also, which
that's
was
some
fun.
Of the investment opportunities.
Yeah.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you. In your presentation, you said you were working for the state of Oregon or have worked. What was that contract?
Right now it's the portal development for the state. We have a small contract to develop a portal, state portal for the Oregon.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Callahan. And Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've also invited Philip Seeley. Philip Seeley is the CEO of Server Logic here in Oregon.
Great. And that's your last invited testimony. Thank you.
We are
right up against it, Mr. Seeley.
Okay, well, I have written testimony to get to you as well.
Get that.
So
thank
if
you.
We don't get through this, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm a resident of Westland. I'm currently the CEO of ServerLogic, but prior to that, I was the Chief Information Officer for CNF Transportation for approximately 8 years. I believe there's significant opportunity for the state to achieve significant cost reductions and improve their service levels by consolidating its IT infrastructure. And I differentiate that from outsourcing it, which is a totally separate issue. I should add, it's not a black and white alternative. It's a grayscale. Total consolidation may not be possible, but some consolidation should enable some rather significant savings for the state. By way of example, I'd like to give you a perspective for what can be achieved. CNF Transportation has sales in excess of $5 billion a year. They're a holding company that operates a number of heterogeneous transportation logistics companies, some acquired through merger. As a result, there were multiple data centers and networks serving the business entities. During my tenure as CIO, their IT expenses were in excess of $200 million a year. While each of the companies had a number of complex mission-critical systems, there wasn't a commonality of vision for IT. There were significant cultural differences and variances in the computing architecture and age of the platforms. We initiated a major consolidation effort in order to reduce cost. Initially, operating company differences or desire for independence and some parochial agendas on the part of some of the IT groups proved an obstacle, but with the support of top management, these were overcome, and four data centers and the network were consolidated into one at CNF's administrative offices in Northwest Portland. The net result was a reduction in cost of over $45 million a year compared to a budget of approximately $220 million a year. The first phase was focused on getting a shared network. This then enabled the data center consolidation to occur more easily. The scope of the consolidation included network services, the help desk, desktop support, system admin, and data center operations. It didn't include development. The entire process took approximately 18 months. 2 years after it was completed, the company engaged the services of an IT benchmarking company to measure the efficiency of the consolidated operations. Of 228 large corporations and outsourcing providers that were measured, we were judged to be in the top 5% based on unit cost of delivery. So I think there's a very real opportunity to achieve significant cost reductions and improve delivery by consolidating the IT infrastructure. I'll give you another quick example from another state. I recently attended a conference focused on Wi-Fi for the trucking industry, sponsored by Volvo Trucks at their U.S. headquarters in North Carolina. If you're not familiar with Wi-Fi, it stands for wireless fidelity. It allows you to connect to a network node by radio frequency and then from there connect to a private network or the Internet. Among the participants were representatives from Virginia Tech on behalf of the Virginia Department of Transportation. Part of their presentation touched on how the DOT had been able to use Wi-Fi technology to dramatically expand the use of road cams for highway and road monitoring without having to incur the cost of providing bandwidth. They used Wi-Fi to connect the road cams into the public school data network at the nearest school to the road cam. By sharing that network, which the state funded, the DOT was able to deliver a much more comprehensive solution to the traveling public and the public safety agencies for a fraction of the cost. By sharing the network infrastructure, the state of Virginia is able to provide a significantly greater public service for dramatically lower cost. I certainly don't have in-depth knowledge or experience with the IT infrastructure of the state. My understanding is it has a lot of similarities to the CNF environment I discussed a minute ago. If that's the case, then I believe very strongly that there are tremendous opportunities to achieve cost reductions while simultaneously improving delivery of service. My experience leads me to believe this can't be achieved from the bottom up. It has to come from the top down. There's too many conflicting agendas, too many parochial interests. I don't think it's unreasonable to expect a 15 to 20% reduction in cost by intelligent consolidation. The state currently spends well in excess of $1 billion. So even if you only get a fraction of that in reduced cost, I think there's an opportunity to save at least $100 million a year. And if that's a goal that you wish to pursue, the leadership and commitment has to come from the legislature and the state. As a concerned citizen, I urge you to take the steps necessary to pursue this objective. Our state's certainly challenged financially, and while you debate the relative merits of changes in our tax structure, you also need to take steps to eliminate waste in government. While many citizens believe changes in our tax structure need to be made, virtually every citizen believes there's an opportunity for state government to be more efficient. And on the surface, spending on information technology appears to be one of those areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Seeley. Excellent testimony. Any questions, Mr. Seeley? Thank you very kindly. We appreciate your testimony, your written testimony as well. Thank you very much, Representative Gallegos, for the presentation. With that, we will go ahead and close this public hearing on House Bill 3529. Representative Bates is he in the room. Okay. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3394 related to trauma services. And Representative Alan Bates, if you'd like to come forward, please, and we will turn the schedule to you. I beg your pardon that we are about 7 minutes behind schedule, but we will proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Butler and committee members. For the record, Alan Bates, State Representative from District 5, Ashland. You have before you House Bill 3394, which I'm going to go over very quickly with you. We have a lot of people behind me that is a coalition that supports this bill concerning our trauma system in the state of Oregon. The trauma system is a system in the state of Oregon that actually came out of the Vietnam experience, where we determined that in that first hour after an injury, you can get that patient to a trauma center by fast transportation and into a trauma hospital. You could save lives. That means you have to have an organized, functioning system with communications, transportation, and surgeons and anesthesiologists in a hospital ready to receive them. That system was pioneered in this state. This is one of the first states the union ever did it, and it's worked well. However, in the last 5 to 7 years, that system is now in jeopardy because of lack of funding. The bill before you will partially answer the question of lack of funding. It will not resolve the entire issue, but it's a big first step in the right direction. Right now, we have a trauma system that is arranged in levels of care by hospital, by what they can do. There's two level ones, both those in Portland. There's level threes, and there's level twos, and there's level fours. Our level two hospitals, because of lack of funding, are dropping into threes. Our threes are dropping into fours, and some of our fours are going out of business. This bill is to bring more money into the system to help that happen. There are multiple sources of funding for trauma. Some of it comes from commercial health insurance. Some comes from the Medicaid system. Some comes from the Medicare system. And a portion of it comes from personal injury protection on your auto insurance. Automobile trauma is the leading cause of people entering the trauma system, so this is an important facet of it. The PIP minimum for insurance has not been changed in the 1970s. It's set at $10,000. This bill would raise it to $15,000, with the additional $5,000 being dedicated to trauma only. What we want to do today is talk to you about what that $5,000 can do and what the system does. I want to tell you also that this bill initially had some money from 911 that was taken out of it. That 911 money would have made the system whole. We may be looking at that in the interim, or other methods of funding the system in the interim that would do more than this present bill does. You may also see a companion bill to this, which would raise the limit to $15,000 across the board, and which would impose in that system workman's comp rates, which are an important asset or aspect of this, as there is some concern about where some of the money from the PIP money goes as far as certain providers are that are obtaining those funds. I don't want to take a lot of your time, because I know we're running late, and I want the people behind me to have an opportunity to speak to this. In essence, what this bill does is sets aside an additional $5,000 per claim, per insurer, as a minimum, that goes directly to the trauma system, and can be used to support our trauma system, both ambulances, EMTs, and the hospitals, and the physicians and providers at those hospitals. It carefully defines it. You will note this is at the A in growth in front of you. You will find one amendment to that, which is the A5, and that simply makes certain that the language reflects that ambulance services are and air services are involved in this, and they have a right to that money also. Mr. Chair, I don't want to take more of your time, but I want to have other people a chance to speak. Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions for Representative Bates? Representative Bates, if you'd like to take a seat right here at the dais, we'd invite you to do that.
Thank you.
Go ahead, if you would, please invite those that of your testimony that have been invited. Dr. Higginson, you're up first on the list there. If you'd like to enter and sign in, beg your pardon for being a little late here.
Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to show the department's support of House Bill 3394, which we have been working with Representative Bates and others in the coalition for quite some time now. From previous times I have talked to the legislature, I think you know that we in public health, what we really try to do is primary prevention. We try to stop bad things from happening in the first place. That is not always possible, and the second best thing is to make early diagnosis and get people into definitive care as quickly as possible. And as Dr. Bates mentioned, there is this golden hour in trauma cases that we really try to get people into definitive care. As Dr. Bates also mentioned, we in Oregon have done pioneering work around a trauma system, and where I think Oregon has really made some advances ahead of other places is making sure that there is a statewide system that covers everybody, even those in rural areas, and includes smaller rural hospitals as well. In the trauma system, the department's role is certification and licensure. We certify all emergency medical technicians in the state. We license ambulance services. We also have a trauma system of hospitals where we go out and assure that hospitals are providing the level of services that they're providing given that they're supposed to be providing given their specific designation. And a disturbing trend that we've seen over the last several years is that instead of trying to build up their trauma systems, hospitals are actually scaling back. Right now, the trauma system is, I would say, in a fragile state, and I think if things get worse, that patients could actually become at risk. And the bottom line for this is due to inadequate reimbursement. And just as an example, we're talking about the PIP, the personal injury protection, it can be as little as $10,000. Well, right now, the average case of a patient in the trauma system is over $30,000. Clearly recognize that increasing the personal injury protection is not the total answer. However, I think that increasing it by $5,000, which would mean, I think, just a reasonable increase to the insured, but then targeting that $5,000 specifically on trauma services in the early parts following an accident, that I think that that is a very good start. So I'll close by saying again, the department's supportive of this bill and hope that you will be as well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Higginson. Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Higginson, on line 25 on page 2, where the definition of trauma services is written out, means services provided within 72 hours of a motor vehicle accident. Do you see any difficulty in defining trauma services so narrowly related to motor vehicles when there can be traumatic falls, there can be airplane crashes, there can be other kinds of traumas? I know this speaks to the PIP insurance, but do you see any difficulty in defining trauma services this way in statute?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, motor vehicle accidents do comprise the majority of trauma cases that we've seen in the trauma system, between two-thirds and three-fourths. So it does address the major cause of trauma patients. Also, it would be putting money into the system so that although it's specifically for this because it's tied to the PIP with automobile and insurance, I still think it's going to be a support for the entire trauma system.
I understand the nexus between the PIP and this definition, but I just wanted to get on the record any questions about the fact that you narrowly define it this way.
Is Dr. Higginson, is that because, and I need to have a better feel for the nexus between the personal injury protection, is that because primarily the insurance that we're looking at is automobile insurance that we're talking about here?
Yeah.
I mean, probably not a lot of folks out there on bicycles that are hitting each other that have this kind of insurance.
Mr. Chair, that is my understanding.
Okay.
The PIP is the vehicles, we have matched it up.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions for Dr. Higginson? Thank you very much. Dr. Bates, Representative Bates, go ahead.
Is Joe Bell here?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3394. I am Jill Bell, and I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I just wanted to mention that OAHHS represents the level one trauma hospitals, being Legacy Emmanuel and OHSU in Portland, as well as the three level two, which is St. Charles and Sacred Heart and Samaritan Health Services. Those are in Bend, Eugene, and Corvallis. And we also represent the 56 other facilities that make up the level three and four levels of the trauma system. Maintaining an effective hospital-based trauma system is one of our highest priorities, and we are very supportive of 3394. We believe it will bolster Oregon's once strong trauma system that is now struggling. Hospitals like Salem Hospital and Rogue Valley in Medford, which once maintained level two traumas, have withdrawn from that level and are now level three centers. And that has a ripple effect on the smaller hospitals in the areas that also provide trauma services and feed into those higher level trauma centers, so that the care is diminished in all levels of the hospitals. We would also like to particularly thank Representative Bates, as well as Representative Patridge, who's been working on other emergency system issues this session, because they recognized, with their knowledge of what was going on in Rogue Valley, that this was a problem, and that they also understood that it was a problem in the rest of the state. We believe that that there are a number of reasons for this stress on the trauma system. Among those are decreasing payments in Medicare and Medicaid, the liability crisis, economic problems with more and more people being uninsured, which means that there are more patients who are going to be needing the care from the trauma system because they will be uninsured. The other issues are shortages of trained personnel, as you've all heard of the workforce issues involved, and that also has an impact on the trauma system. One of the things that has happened across the state and that Representative Bates is very familiar with is the fact that it's very difficult without adequate funding and support to get the kinds of trauma care that is needed from neurosurgeons and other emergency care specialists. So that's another area that's been a real issue for hospitals in providing the care that is demanded when there is a trauma. We believe that 3394 takes the much-needed step, and that it will increase the PIP benefits will help. One of the comments I believe that Dr. Higginson made was the cost. And according to some data that the Oregon Office of Health Policy and Research has, it showed that the average claim for hospital trauma services, and this is just the hospital piece only, in a sample from about 1,000 cases in 2000, was over $41,000, and that those charges actually range from about $2,500 to over $750,000. So there's a huge range of costs, and while we really appreciate and support the addition for the PIP benefits, we still believe that there's a ways to go on this issue. So anything that can be done to help the process, we really appreciate. And thank you for your time. And
thank you very much, Joe. I appreciate you bringing this testimony forward. Are there questions of Joe Bell from the Orient Hospital? Thank you very much, Joe. Dr. Bates.
John Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman and members, we have been working with Dr. Bates for several months now on the concepts involved in this bill. And as he mentioned in his testimony, there is a companion bill to this that will be likely be referred to this subcommittee soon. That's House Bill 2572, and we talked to one of the co-chairs this morning about getting it to this subcommittee. And the purpose of moving that legislation to this committee to be considered along with 3394 is that we believe a concept of increasing the PIP by $5,000 across the board, as opposed to the limited increase to just trauma, can be accomplished with a much smaller impact on the people who pay for this insurance, the policyholders. And we would do that, as Dr. Bates explained, by adopting a fee schedule, a provider fee schedule, that would be attached to the legislation so that the increased amount of money would be appropriately spent, or hopefully more appropriately spent. Who would impose that? It would be providers who are outliers in the billing process. They bill maybe twice as much as other providers for the same types of service. But let me explain to you what is happening right now with people who are involved in automobile insurance accidents. If they go into a provider and that provider charges an unreasonable amount of money for their service, that insured person, or in this case, the injured party, is caught in the middle of a law, that PIP law, that simply says that the automobile insurer shall pay a reasonable fee for service. But reasonable is not fine. So if the insurance company says, in this community, this service should have been $300 and you're charging $550 or $600, we're going to pay you what the providers in this community charge for that service. We're not going to pay you this unreasonable fee. What will happen in that case is the insurer will pay the provider then will balance bill the injured party. The injured party will call the insurance company and say, why didn't you pay for this? And now that injured party is between the provider and the insurance company on what is reasonable. And that's the only way an insurance company today can challenge the reasonableness of medical billings. The workers' comp fee schedule, which is used in other states for automobile medical claims, is a system that is updated every 3 months. It is systematically done by a firm that's hired to go out and survey medical costs. That survey and the results of that go to an advisory committee over DCBS, and every 3 months they update that fee schedule. Those fees that are allowed are better than commercial rates in health insurance. So it is a fair system. It is not a system that's trying to push providers aside. So we will have amendments to the bill, the companion bill to this, drafted, and Representative Bates' staff is forwarding those to council today, so we should have those in a very short period of time. So that's what we're going to go forward. What is also, I think, important for the committee to understand is that PIP benefits, or medical benefits of the auto policy, never have been designed to replace health insurance. If the limits were ever raised to take in all medical costs, people will not be able to afford automobile insurance. In fact, some people can't afford it today. State Farm, in February of this year, took a double-digit rate increase in the state of Oregon for the same reason health insurance is going up. Many of these costs are starting to be real drivers. We have about 12% of Oregonians drive without automobile insurance today, even though it's a requirement under the law. There's only one reason people would do that. It's not because they necessarily want to, it's because they can't afford it. Any kind of cost pressure we put on the system is going to create more of those people. And those people going to trauma centers, if they do not have health insurance, there is nothing there to pay these bills. So we're hoping that our amendments that come forward in that companion bill will be a win-win. We'll be able to increase the limits, help the trauma system, at the same time not putting a real spike in rate increases. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would stop and answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Sean. Just one question. The financial impact on the policyholders at present, do you have any kind of estimate what that would be?
Mr. Chairman, we do not have that yet. We're currently working on that. Okay. It is very difficult to get that kind of information, more difficult than one would think. For example, every state's laws are different in this regard. For example, in Washington State, medical coverage on an auto policy is optional. You don't have to have the equivalent of PIP in Washington State. You can buy it, and it's offered. In Oregon, we have a minimum limit of $10,000. What this legislation is doing is pushing that minimum limit up. Currently, you can buy more PIP coverage, and many, many people do. That's in State Farm's book of business. A lot of their insureds have higher PIP limits because they have a very, very well-trained agency force that sits down with people to explain what could happen to them and their passengers. Their passengers are covered by this coverage as well. So we will be getting that information very shortly, Mr. Chairman, and I think by the time our companion bill is here and we have those amendments,
excellent,
we'll have that.
Thank you. Questions, further questions, Representative Johnson?
Thank you. Mr. Powell, I just want to make sure that I understand your amendments are heading in a direction that would try to prevent the insured from becoming caught between providers and the insurance company.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that's correct.
Thank you.
And those will be amendments, follow-up, relative to House Bill 2572.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct because of the relating clause. I was working with Representative Bates, and he was kind enough to give us authority to get them drafted to
excellent
this bill, but they're broader than just trauma, although we think the effect would be the same.
Is it in Ways and Means Committee
yeah,
right now?
We're trying to get it assigned to your committee here.
But it is here in Ways and Means.
It is in Ways and Means. Now it's been transferred from Judiciary, I believe.
Yes. Okay.
And we would be supportive of that bill to actually supersede this bill if it actually came forward. It's broader and in some ways simpler. And
you are having the necessary amendments.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
We are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John. Dr. Bates Allen.
Yes. Susan King. Our registered nurse from St. Vincent's, who I understand was working late last night at the ER.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Susan King, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. As Dr. Bates has indicated, my clinical practice is in emergency nursing. Currently, I practice in a system that's being overwhelmed. I know all of you have heard various stories about what is overwhelming our healthcare system today. However, I think we very definitely support this bill because we know that there are a variety of different approaches that can be taken to deal with a system that clearly is underfunded from many different funding sources. Last night in the emergency department, I did a quick snapshot of the patients that we had. We had 7 victims of a motor vehicle accident at one time. And as much as I could glean from the charts, 2 of those 7 patients had no funding source, at least healthcare funding source. What the status of their PIP under their auto insurance is unknown to me. But we see every day patients who are coming into our hospitals. Nurses see patients as primary care providers, as hospital-based practitioners, and as home health nurses, for example, who see the long-term effects of auto accidents. And so we know that any incremental change we can make in reimbursement that will offer the care people need at a reasonable cost is something that we very much support. So I would urge your support of this bill or a companion bill that might be coming forward to you to help solve this problem for our patients.
Thank you, Ms. King. Are there questions, Ms. King, at this time? Thank you very kindly. I appreciate you coming. Dr. Bates, Representative Bates.
Thank you. Whatever. Sean Baer, EMT. And then I.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association in support of House Bill 3394 with the -5 amendments that are essential for our inclusion. It's likely that we would also support the other bill that has been referred to, and we'll certainly be taking a close look at it. Our members are ground and air ambulance providers and private companies and public agencies providing 911 emergency ambulance service to much of the state. Our members are usually the access to and the first step of trauma care for accident victims. With me is our association president, Sean Baird, who is also the president and co-owner of Woodburn Ambulance, serving parts of Marion County. Sean is also a working paramedic, and I mention this because it is very typical of our members, the company presidents and in the case of public agencies, the managers of emergency medical services tend to be paramedics, and they still go out on calls. They're a very hard-working group of people dedicated to providing the best emergency ambulance care that they can. The biggest obstacle that they face these days is uncompensated care. Emergency ambulance services must serve all patients, regardless of their insurance status, regardless of their ability to pay. As John Powell mentioned, 12% of accident victims or drivers have no insurance at all, automobile insurance. Sean told me something yesterday that I felt illustrated the problem they have with uncompensated costs and the impact on trauma care. He said that last year there was only one thing that prevented him from having to take ambulances out of service, even as the population in his area was growing. And that one thing was the leadership last session from Senator Winter's subcommittee to increase reimbursement for ambulance services to Medicaid and Oregon Health Plan patients. Without that, his company, and I'm sure others, would actually have had to cut service. And when you do that, when you take ambulances out of service, you increase response times and you increase the likelihood that lives will be lost. And with that, this session I want to mention, our ray of hope is House Bill 3394. It's a smaller piece of the uncompensated care picture, but it is an important one to us.
Thank you very much.
I'll turn it over to Sean.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Barrett. I'm the owner and paramedic with Woodburn Ambulance Service and with the Oregon State Ambulance Association as president. I just wanted to point out from a personal perspective and from my company's perspective what has happened in the last couple of years with emergency services. We've had a rise in uncompensated care that each of the last 2 years has doubled. 3 years ago, we had about $250,000 a year in uncompensated care in the Woodburn and Silverton area. Last year, it was about $500,000, and this year, it's expected to be about $1 million. This is from a variety of reasons, federal Medicare reimbursement, caps on Medicaid reimbursement, which is, as Nan pointed out, we got significant relief from and that helped, but there are so many parts of this puzzle that every single one of them is critical to making this work. Our volume continues to increase. We're running a third again as many emergency calls as we were a couple years ago, but fortunately with at least the same number of units, we really should be adding more. Our response times are creeping up by 4 and 5 minutes. You may think, well, 4 or 5 minutes doesn't sound like a whole lot, but for someone who's been critically injured in an accident, as we've been hearing earlier about the golden hour, a few minutes essentially is the difference between whether or not the patient is really going to survive the accident or not. And we just really ask your support for the PIP increase on trauma services because it's the only thing that's going to keep us out there and doing the job.
Thank you very much, Sean. And so last year, if I understand your written testimony here, is that your company absorbed about $25,000 in unpaid claims which were related to the personal injury protection alone.
Specifically related to the PIP.
Okay.
Yes.
And had you House Bill 3394 been in effect, then that $25,000 would have been collected. And more?
We anticipate about $25,000 would have been collected with the proposal in this bill.
That would be the difference of adding on the additional service that you feel.
That's a considerable amount for a small agency like ours.
Thank you very much. Further questions for either Sean or Nan?
No, but I'd just like to thank them for their comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good work that you've done.
And I know that there's been an increase in auto accidents on I-5.
I worked on the 4th of July and worked on a motor vehicle accident, a pickup that was involved in a rollover, and we had several patients out of that one single accident. And it reminded me, just as Susan King was mentioning, how much of what we do is related to motor vehicle accidents.
Mr. Chair, just to comment, I think sometimes we look at things as singular, and the work that's being done with respect to accidents and the trauma centers are multiple. And I know last session when I got into and learned about the issue last session, you know, we worked very hard to make sure that we are increasing our compensation. It's huge in the medical field. This is just one piece, I think, of an overarching problem as we look at delivering health care services in Oregon. And I need to say that because we're taking care of this piece, hopefully, but I still believe that we need to get busy as policymakers and address the overall broader comprehensive issue of our healthcare delivery system in Oregon, which includes the emergency systems as well as adequate staffing and what have you. We're nibbling at the edges, and this is one policymaker who believes that we need to devote some time during this interim to come up with the really concrete and comprehensive solutions. I don't think we're going to ever get ahead or even level with this, with our health care needs in this state.
Thank you, Senator.
I just had to.
Chair, a quick comment before I leave. Senator Winters, I couldn't agree with you more. We've had this conversation before. You're absolutely correct. Well, I'd like to point out that EMTs don't just pick people up anymore. These people stabilize in the field. We start IVs, defibrillate, you do what they can, do an excellent job to stabilize in the field. And I find them especially important in rural areas where you may have a long transport and the need for that transport from a rural area into a one or a two level trauma center is really, really vital for saving lives and probably in some ways the most important step for us, especially in rural settings. And we're all going to be in those rural settings sometime. We'll be on vacation or we'll be traveling, and bad things can happen. So what these people do is really outstanding. I'm just totally impressed by what I see happening on the field these days compared to even 10 years ago. It's an amazing feat you guys do out there.
Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you, man. Dr. Bates, let me just ask this one question relative to your needs in Southern Oregon. What is the air ambulance response time to a trauma 2 level center? I guess that would either be in Bend or Corvallis.
It depends. If we're transferring hospital to hospital, we're pretty quick. But if we have problems coming from outlying areas on the coast and eastern Oregon, getting them to St. Charles or to Murrow West or to Rogue Valley, and that's an issue of finances. Again, we got fixed wing. We don't have a lot of helicopter. We have some. But it's part of the system we have to work on.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Johnson?
One interesting piece of that is that some time ago, Senator Wyden was working on trying to procure weather stations that would give real-time weather at many rural airports that don't have real-time weather. And having real-time weather to be able to fly instruments from airport to airport is essential versus calling out a weather observer. And so we still have infrastructure improvements that need to be made at airports to make sure that the air component of the ambulance transport system works.
Particularly during those critical times of the years when weather is a tremendous factor and the experience of accidents is
absolutely
much higher rate. Please proceed, Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're on time, so I'm going to ask Jim Anderson and Scott Gallant to come up, but I'm going to hold them to 5 minutes apiece, which is going to be difficult for these gentlemen, but we'll do it.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. We also support this legislation and will review Mr. Powell's companion bill closely to evaluate its potential impact on the system. I think what you've heard today is just a part of the problems that many healthcare providers are seeing. Our trauma system is having great difficulty, not only due to the $35 million annual shortfall in reimbursement for those services due to a variety of things, but the impact of costs in other areas like malpractice, for example, Neurosurgeons' malpractice costs have gone up at least $30,000 for each neurosurgeon, and will continue to go up until we can stabilize that system. I think, as you're aware, physicians' debt, once they are able to practice, is well in excess of $200,000. Oregon's compensation compared to other regions of the state is significantly less than other parts of the country. So the ability to recruit physicians to provide trauma services or other necessary medical services has become exceedingly difficult. And so Senator Winter's comment and observations about a serious need for the legislature to provide some leadership in the medical workforce issues and other healthcare workforce issues is very, very important and very needed. And we would look forward to any kind of comprehensive review of that issue and developing a comprehensive approach to trying to address it, because it is significant.
Scott, let me just interrupt you right there. Do you know how much of these increases in costs are being driven by Oregon's lack of tort reform?
It is significant. I can get you total numbers of what those costs have gone up for the two major insurers. It's significant and is going to continue to increase rapidly.
I guess I'm trying to separate out all of the elements of this, and I recognize that some of it is externally driven. Well, most all of it is externally driven. I'd just like to be able to put a price tag on each of the various components that are going into the health care issues.
Mr. Chairman, to give you an example, you voted favorably on a short-term, subsidy for just rural physicians, which, you know, is estimated to be at least $10 million a year for the next 4 years if it does ultimately get through the legislative process.
Dr. Bates and I did not have any conflict of interest in the voting yes on that.
That bill is currently stuck in judiciary. I expect it to get out of that committee. But as you know, the large majority of physicians and healthcare providers are in the valley and are not impacted by that. So you can significantly increase the fiscal needs just on that one issue and the impact that that's having on physicians and their practices and their overhead costs. There are other issues at hand. HIPAA is costing millions and millions of dollars to comply with. That is not funded by the feds when it was implemented. So again, medical practices and physicians are bearing those costs in order to comply with confidentiality requirements of just that one law, and will cost Americans billions of dollars for compliance over the course of the next several years. So there are things that are happening, but probably more critical was an example that Dr. Long gave. I'm sorry if I'm going over my time. Is that in Eugene, for example, the neurosurgeons consolidated into one office. And they tried to make serious decisions about what kind of services they can provide or can't provide. And the concern is that if they limit, for example, their services to back surgeries and not doing head trauma, they will be transferring patients to Portland or to Bend or other places in order to avoid the risk of providing neurosurgical services elsewhere, to avoid the risk of major lawsuits in the state. It's very troubling. This bill will help a little bit, but the problem is much broader than just this issue. We hope you'll vote favorably on the bill.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned the malpractice. I just happened to have this article that was given to me this morning, and what it says, don't get sick here. and it's from the Wall Street Journal. The American Medical Association says medical delivery in 19 states is in crisis, and unfortunately one of them. Arkansas, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, New Jersey, Nevada, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Texas, Washington, West Virginia, and Wyoming.
And those in Oregon are liable to have a hunger problem as well as an unemployment problem as well.
Thought I would share that with you, and if you'd like copies of this, I will pass it out to you. But it's you know, I said earlier that we have some major, major problems that we need to address by this body.
Thank you, Senator. Let's go ahead and get to Jim. I don't want to cut Marianne Wish short at the very end here before we are called back to our respective floors and our respective chambers. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Anderson here today representing the Oregon chapter of American College of Emergency Physicians, known as OSEP. And we have submitted written testimony, which you have before you, also representing the Oregon Association of Orthopedists. I'd like to thank Representative Dr. Bates and Representative Patrick for bringing this issue forward. We supported it through the House process and on to today. And also, while we're thanking people, I'd like to thank John Powell for working with us, trying to find a remedy to this, and we are fully in support of House Bill 3394, or if the committee chooses to adopt amendments to House Bill 2572 and pass that issue forward with the language contained in it, we would also be very supportive of that. I'm not going to tread over old ground and discuss the things that have already been discussed. I think we need to get on to other testimony that the chair has already mentioned. With that, I would just urge your support of this issue.
Thank you very much. Questions of either Scott or Jim?
No.
Thank you both very much. Dr. Bates?
Marianne Wish, please. Marianne's previous testimony has put a very human face on this issue, and I'd like to have her enough time to give her testimony again, and we may well ask you to do it one more time and set aside.
Okay.
If things go well, we hope they will.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Marianne Wish. I live at 1537 Southeast 72nd Avenue in Portland. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 3394. Our granddaughter's death showed me that Oregon's trauma system should be better, and this bill is one step in maintaining good trauma care. March 25, 2001 was the usual Sunday morning. My husband and I went to church and did some errands. And when we got home about 1:45, we listened to the one answering machine message. Our daughter Lisa was calling. And her message was, as always, very concise. Mom and Dad, Jean's been in a terrible accident at the beach. Go to Emmanuel Hospital now. And I thought, oh no, our beautiful 13-year-old tap dancer, our artist, our pianist, our honor student, no, no, no. Jean, her sister Helen, and their parents were at the coast for an Anderson family reunion along with her paternal grandparents and three uncles and their families. Jean was rolled over by a several thousand pound, 25-foot log while surfing with her father and two uncles at Short Sands Beach in Oswald West State Park. Her accident occurred at approximately 11:15 in the morning. Within a minute or two, she was pulled from under the log and given mouth to mouth. She regained consciousness. She knew who she was. She knew where she was. And she knew what had happened to her. She talked to her father and her uncles. She said that it hurt to breathe. In the meantime, a witness at the beach, using his cell phone, called 911. And even though the connection was poor, Tillamook 911 quickly dispatched an ambulance from Manzanita and two fire trucks from Nehalem. At 11:27, the ambulance arrived at the parking lot. Shortly thereafter, the EMT paramedic announced a trauma system entry and requested a Coast Guard rescue helicopter. He did not request an air ambulance. Jean was transferred from the surfboard on which she had been put to a Stoke stretcher and moved to another spot on the beach at 11:55, after which they waited and waited and waited. The Coast Guard helicopter arrived at 12:20. A half hour later, as Jean was winched into the hovering helicopter, her last words to her father were, "Daddy, I can't breathe. I think I'm going to die." The helicopter arrived at Emmanuel Hospital at 13:50, 2 hours and 35 minutes after the accident. I was with her in the operating room when she was pronounced dead at 15:31. The emergency medical system failed our granddaughter. There was no golden hour for Jean. Jean became another statistic in unintentional injury deaths in Oregon. The comparative vital statistics data, which includes poisonings, show Oregon as worse than California, worse than Washington, and worse than the national average. I believe passage of House Bill 3394 could keep Oregon's unintentional injury death rate from rising. But this bill does not do enough. An enhanced 911, which shows location of cell phone calls, is needed. That didn't happen with Jean. They had a little problem figuring out where she was. Improved training, including the importance of quickly moving victims from the scene, as well as new protocols concerning launch and use of air ambulances, could make a difference. A patient advocate should be a member of both state trauma advisory boards and the state emergency and medical services committee. I miss my granddaughter. I ache for her parents. As the maternal grandmother, I can't give a kiss and a Band-Aid and make it better for Lisa or Jean. But I would like to know that Jean's death has helped bring about a better trauma system for others. Passage of House Bill 3394 will ensure that surgeons and hospitals continue to care for trauma victims. I strongly support this bill.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the testimony, Mariana, for the information about your beautiful granddaughter. Handout. I guess the one question I have is relative to the Coast Guard helicopter which arrived. It was not medically equipped. Is that?
It is a rescue vehicle in the sense that it's equipped to pull people out of the sea if they are drowning or if their boat has capsized, and it carries with it an oxygen bottle and a first aid kit. That's not quite enough to provide advanced life support.
Not any ENT personnel, nothing of that nature.
There is basic medic on board. The rescue swimmer actually is a basic, but he is not qualified to do any advanced life support.
Does a manual, or and not being that familiar with the coast at Manzanita and Nehalem, does a manual have flights available for EMT helicopters for this particular area?
There is one Life Flight helicopter that is based at Hillsborough, which is associated with Emmanuel. It was not called. I think there is a feeling among many people that Life Flight wouldn't come because the weather was not great that day. Now, I happen to know that the Life Flight helicopter is an IFR helicopter. And I also know that when the weather is really bad over the coast range, they can come down the valley towards Astoria and then come down. But they weren't called that day.
Thank you. Representative Johnson has a helicopter company and being a pilot herself. You share with us your...
Well, it's a little more complex than that. I'm an IFR pilot with 3,500 hours of helicopter time. And part of the dilemma that people don't realize is that the helicopter can't see through the clouds. It has to have an instrument way to come down,
right,
necessitating airport to airport. And so in this case, it would have been Hillsborough or the downtown pad at Emmanuel, and then out to the Tillamook Airport, which is instrument equipped. It couldn't have gone to the beach under any circumstances if the weather was substandard.
That, well, and that's probably correct. I think I would agree with that. However, there was no, and I know that there are many landing sites along Highway 26 where the helicopter could have sat down and the ambulance could have met the helicopter and they could have gotten her much more quickly to the hospital.
In good weather.
The point this case illustrates from my point of view is we had a young lady who probably had a hemothorax. She was probably bleeding into her lungs. So you had time to get her to a hospital, and we didn't have a system set up to handle that. It's a system failure. She should have taken off that beach to the instrument rated airport setting immediately. While she was being transported there, the helicopter should have already been on its way, so they met there and went back to Emmanuel. So it's a system failure, and that's what we're trying to fix. We need to put money in that system so the system will really work.
Does your bill fix the system, or does your bill provide for the providers?
This provides funding into the system, which then will allow us to have the funds we need to have those systems properly set up. We actually are slipping in our systems. We used to have better systems in this state 10 years ago for trauma than we do now, only from the point of view of what happens in the hospital, but what happens outside the hospital also.
Okay, Senator Winters, and then Senator Gale.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to piggyback on that because one of the things I noted, it is a systems issue, because I also noted in your testimony the issue of training.
Yes.
And I think that's very critical when we're talking about being able to contact the right source, being able to provide those emergency services and what have you. So it is a systems problem, and I keep going back to my same conversation that I had earlier, and that we have to address these issues in its systematic way rather than in pieces way. And I really truly thank you for bringing this to our attention. You are correct. And those of us who are kind of involved in the healthcare delivery system really realize the gaps that we have and that we cannot continue in this state with these kinds of gaps in service when it is so critically needed to assist individuals in their time of trauma and need. So I just wanted to add that, and thank you for coming and sharing with us.
Thank you, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wish, thank you for coming here. My question actually is to Dr. Bates, actually. That is, when you have a tragedy like this, well, is there any formal review? I mean, does someone review this? I mean, because I think that's the way things get improved, and that's the way that, you know, changes are made in the system. There has to be some kind of formal review that whether the right actions were taken or not taken, or what should have been done differently.
Mrs. Wish has actually spoken to that. We have a trauma board that reviews these and tries to improve the system, but if you haven't got funding for that, it doesn't get done. And that's what this is about. This is about a funding issue so that the system can be strengthened again, get back to where it should have been before and improved upon. We are slipping behind other states in the ability to handle trauma patients from the point of view of getting to them in the field and getting to the right place quickly and then having the right facilities there when you get there. And the answer to your question is yes. She would also like to see, and I support this, that an advocate be on the trauma board so that they can bring these kind of information and stories forward so there's a clear understanding of the need. And to do a statewide system like that, in some areas of the state where you have very, very thin ability to deal with trauma, is difficult. When you're out in Southeast Oregon, as an example, it's pretty slim out there. We need to help those people with a better system. That's why Dr. Higgins is here also, because his department is responsible for maintaining the trauma system and improving the trauma system in cases like this.
I guess, Dr. Bates, my question back to the bill again, when I read on page 2, line 43, paragraph B under Section 2 talks about that the medical expense benefits required under Paragraph A of this subsection are exhausted an additional $5,000 for trauma services. The availability of benefits under this paragraph do not reduce the amount that the trauma service provider may recover under this paragraph of this section. It appears that this money goes to the trauma service providers.
It does, but when it goes, if it goes to the people who do the transport, as an example, they send their people in for more education and training if they're getting properly trained, and that's the system way it works.
Okay.
Plus, there's money that comes in from the state for maintaining the trauma system itself, an administrative role. But as more money goes out to these systems, especially EMTs and the ambulance services, they can then afford to get the people there trained to put better systems together.
But the primary beneficiaries of this particular bill, as presently constituted, would be the primary would be the trauma service providers.
Correct, including the transport people.
Exactly, and that's that would have addressed some of the issues here.
Yes,
but I'm anxious to know that it doesn't come into a State Department where it gets washed in a black hole.
We want this to go to where the rubber hits the road.
Okay, thank you very much.
I have to say in this context.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wish. Further questions? If not, we're a little bit over time, but thank you very much. We'll look forward to. Dr. Bates, the potential of 2572 coming down as well.
Thank
with
you.
That, we will close general government for today until, tomorrow.
Tomorrow's meeting has been canceled.
Tomorrow's meeting with the Secretary of State, unfortunately, has been canceled, so we'll move that over to next week.
Staff wasn't available.
Okay.
So we're going to try to.